Cheers,
ladies and gentlemen.
Cheers.
I've been trying to find different ways to present classical music. I don't think we're trained enough in talking about what we do, because the music that we play is terribly interesting, but again, the way that it's presented is not.
Welcome to Pour Me a Mozart. My name is Asia, and I'm here with Christian.
Hi.
Hello. And we are drinking to vodka stuff and Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. So, hi again. Thanks for being here. You're my first official out-of-state guest.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'm so honored.
Yeah. So you're actually also in a different time zone. So kind of
a whole hour.
A whole hour. A fun little COVID thing that I got to do.
Yes.
So how are you?
I'm good. Trying to keep from going crazy right now because I've been out of work for, about 2.5 months now? So, and been stuck in my apartment and then also just homeschooling my kids during the day, and they're driving me crazy. And other than that, I'm doing fine. I'm doing fantastic.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah, I can't imagine being a parent at this time.
It sucks.
That's very blunt. You love your kids.
Absolutely. I love them more than anything on this planet. And yet I want to strangle them every day.
Yeah, maybe don't say that publicly in a worldwide podcast.
Oh, I do anyway. I'm kidding. No, I adore my children. But they are just very headstrong, free-spirited. Getting them to sit down and do any kind of schoolwork is, it's a struggle every day.
Yeah, I believe it. Are you, so I guess briefly I should back up and say that we met because we played in the Sioux City Symphony together. You're also a violinist.
Yeah.
Are you still teaching violin?
Oh yeah, a whole bunch. I live in the Charleston, South Carolina area now, and I teach at the Charleston Academy of Music, and then I have a violin program that I teach through one of the orchestras here in one of the Title I North Charleston elementary schools. So quite a few kiddos when we are actually in school.
Yeah, are you doing any online lessons?
Yes, my private students I am, but that's about it.
Okay. Yeah, I, well, in the last couple of weeks of school, I'm supposed to put together some stuff for the school program that I was teaching at, which will be interesting because I just started that in February and I haven't seen those kids since March. So I had 2 months with the kids and
oh man,
then it's going to be like, hi, remember me? I'm your other violin teacher. Do stuff. But yeah, so I don't know if you and I have talked about this, but going back to how we met, do you remember our first interaction?
I think you messaged me
on
Messenger.
Yeah.
I was like, who is this person?
Yeah, so we saw each other at the same audition, and you had already been in the orchestra, but you beat me for the assistant concertmaster chair, or whatever the title was.
Yeah.
And then I was looking around for things to do in the summer and I saw you on the faculty of,
that's right,
of something else. And, I was like, you know what, instead of being the usual super competitive person that I am, I'm going to be friends with this person that beat me in an audition. I kind of forced you to be my friend.
I'm glad you did. No, it was funny because, yeah, you messaged me and then I was like, who is this person? I don't even remember if I responded, but then I remember seeing you at rehearsal and you introduced yourself and I was like, who are you? And then like, oh yeah, I remember. I'm so sorry. I forgot. Yeah, that's right. I did forget to respond to you because that's what I do.
Hey, it's okay. You're like, weird girl. Meh.
Yeah. Which, I mean, is fine. And now look at us. We're like old friends now. It's awesome.
Yeah. And actually, I feel like our violin connection goes back even farther than us meeting, because your primary teacher, and then a teacher that was very important to me, though I only studied with her for a couple of years, but our past teachers were very good friends.
Want to remind me, who was that again?
Mary West and
That's Barbara. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were buds.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Mary West, she was one of my first chamber music coaches at Madeline Island Music Camp.
Oh, that's where I met Barton.
Yeah, and when I was 17, I remember she coached my quartet on the first movement of Beethoven Opus 18, number 4.
Oh, is
Trippy.
That?
Trippy.
How does that one go?
Dee-do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's a trip. That was a really long time ago. Wow.
Yeah. I went to Madeline Island one summer also, and Mary was never my coach. Barton was also never my coach. I feel like we always got the guest musicians because, like, I didn't really deserve to go there. I got in because someone else left or decided to go somewhere else. So I just got, like, the guest who they were like, you only have to deal with her for 1 week.
Oh, well, it's still, I mean, it's such a great place to be, you know. They always had a great faculty. And
they really
such a,
did.
You know, a great environment to study in.
Yeah, and it's a really beautiful place.
Yeah, I mean, that place kind of saved me in some ways.
Yeah.
When I was a teenager, because I was a stressed out teenager. Holy cow. I had some issues, and going to Madeline Island totally, I guess, leveled me out, made me realize there's stuff out there bigger than myself, mm-hmm. and so really helped out with a lot of that teen angst I was going through.
Yeah, so. Music, the anti-angst.
Yeah.
So before all of this started, you were playing in a bunch of different orchestras in the Carolina area, right?
Carolina or Dakota?
I guess I don't know.
Before COVID, you mean?
Before COVID, yeah.
Sorry. I'm getting confused. Yes. I play in a bunch of groups down here. I play with the Charleston Symphony, North Charleston Pops, some other smaller groups, and even recently I started going out and playing with the Chattanooga Symphony, and I was hoping to, you know, eventually branch out to some other groups in the area, and I also have some solo projects that I'm working on that I would like to eventually take on the road, but
can you share
we'll
anything
see.
About that?
I'll tell a little bit about it. I don't want to give too much away.
Okay.
But it has to do with I've been trying to find different ways to present classical music, because it's my opinion that the way our craft is presented these days is rather boring.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just so bored to tears with the same old stuff, like the same old programming. And the way that classical musicians talk about what we do, I think is, I'm just gonna come out and be super critical of it. I don't like it. I don't think we're trained enough in talking about what we do,
mm-hmm.
because the music that we play is terribly interesting. But again, the way that it's presented is not. Anyway, so I was thinking about that, and I came up with an idea. It's a storytelling idea that it's coming in. The end result is that it's looking like a one-person show. And so I'm telling a story and interjecting some pieces of music, so on and so forth. But one huge influence on it has been my studies of improv comedy in the last year and a half.
Yeah, I was wondering if that tied in.
Yeah, and actually I started doing the improv as a way to help me out, to further just basically give me experience with orating and with organizing a thought and then telling it to an audience. Because, you know, so many times in the past when I would talk to an audience, I would just do it off the cuff, and it just was not a good idea. Like,
yeah.
And so when actually, when I have a chance to organize my thoughts and present it in an organized way, then it's, you know, much more meaningful. So that's why I did the improv comedy thing, but then it kind of wound up going off into completely, it got a mind of its own, in a good way. And so, and the people that I've met and the help that I've gotten along the way to produce this thing and write it has been invaluable. So it should be interesting once it's up and running, but it's just it's an extremely slow process because I have to memorize all the music. And then writing this thing, like I'm on like my fifth draft at this point.
Wow.
And it's, yeah, it's kind of, just takes a long time.
Well, that's cool.
We'll see.
I can't wait to see it when it happens.
See it / hear it, yeah.
Yeah.
Some of it'll be like pretty funny. Good. But it's also going to have to come with a disclaimer because there are some, there's a lot of adult language in it. And there's some scenes of violence, mild scenes of violence in it. that'll give you an idea what what might be in the story.
So. It sounds like an opera.
A little bit, yeah. It's actually a story of something that happened to me when I lived in Minneapolis years ago. So, but that's all I'm going to say.
I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds great. I love that. I mean, there are obviously things that suck a lot about being in isolation. But what I like is that we kind of have more freedom to do the projects that we want to do rather than, you know, jumping from orchestra to orchestra, preparing like one program a week and just, you know, doing the things that people are telling us to do.
And absolutely.
I think I spent the majority of the beginning of quarantine because I, you know, none of us know how long this is going to last, but I spent the beginning of it like kind of preparing for the next thing and like the next thing that I should be preparing for. And then I kind of hit a wall where I was like, you know what, why don't I just do what I want to do?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where I'm at now.
Yeah. I mean, I did the exact same thing. Only, I mean, my schedule was so busy before this thing happened that once I had all this free time, I was like, oh my gosh, I actually get to practice some stuff that's been on my to-do list for like months, if not years at this point.
Yeah.
So
I'm still it's waiting been for nice. This in the mail, but I ordered Prokofiev 2. I've never learned it.
Really? Nice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been working on Paganini Caprices the last 2 weeks.
Nice.
So, and I learned the Prokofiev solo sonata. I did that one.
Oh boy.
Yeah, that was, no, that piece is super cool. It's really interesting. And then what's that?
Oh, it's pretty challenging though, isn't it?
It's not too bad actually.
Huh. Okay.
And the first movement is a lot of fun because it's like that happy, chipper, snide Prokofiev.
Okay.
So, you know, where it's like it sounds happy, but really underneath the surface, it's probably like flipping you the bird type thing, you know?
Yeah, very Russian thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I finished memorizing a Bach fugue like a month ago.
Nice.
So,
congratulations.
Man, that was, I don't know how some people do it, but I don't know. These days, I'm finding that memorizing music is actually becoming easier, so.
Oh, probably we should talk about that after the recording.
Absolutely.
Because it's really hard for me.
Yeah.
One of the reasons is because this was going to be a smooth segue until I started giggling at myself a little bit. because several years ago, I started working in a restaurant and discovered the world of cocktails. And I started drinking a lot more than I ever had before. But I was going to ask you, what is your go-to drink?
Oh, boy. It used to be beer and probably too much of it. But I used to be a big beer snob. But then in the last, year? Yeah. I switched over to more like vodka, soda type things. And mainly for weightlifting and weight reasons, just mm-hmm. because, you know, beer is so full of sugar and it just gets stored. And especially with me being middle-aged, automatically gets stored as belly fat. And I, these days, you know, I'm trying to like be more conscious about my health and cholesterol levels and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so I found that switching over to especially vodka in particular, I could have beverages and enjoy them and not get nearly as fat.
So. Yeah, I went through a vodka soda phase.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you drinking right now?
Vodka soda.
It has some color to it, though. What else is in there? Just
a splash of cranberry juice.
Oh, okay. I'm drinking something pretty similar.
Yours looks delicious.
Oh, yeah. It's a take on a Cosmo. I had thought about doing a raspberry martini, but then I realized that I've already done that on this show.
Nice.
So a Cosmo is typically vodka, triple sec, and lime juice. Oh, and a splash of cranberry to make it, you know, that pink color people associate with it. But I didn't have all of that stuff, so including non-flavored vodka. So I made a raspberry Cosmo, which has 1.5 ounces raspberry vodka, 1/2 ounce of Grand Marnier, which replaced the triple sec. Grand mm-hmm. Marnier is like a fancier orange liqueur. 0.25 ounces of Chambord, which is a raspberry liqueur, and then 1/2 ounce of lime juice. So I shook it up and poured it in a martini glass. I put the glass in my freezer this morning, so when it came out, it was all nice and frosty. It obviously is not anymore. But
fun fact about Grandma, I think I live in the one part of the United States that has the highest consumption of Grandma. Grand Marnier.
Oh,
that's what they call it down here. Grandma.
We call it Granny. I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Grandma. Okay.
Yeah, they call it Grandma down here.
I thought you were going to tell me a fun fact about your grandma and that she likes to drink Cosmos.
I wish. She would have been a much more fun grandma. I'm kidding. I should not talk smack about my grandmother. She was a wonderful woman.
Can you say the fun fact again? I was distracted.
Oh, I live in the area that has the highest consumption of Grand Marnier in the country.
Okay.
Which is like Charleston. Well, technically I'm in Somerville, but like the Charleston area.
Interesting. Do you know why that is?
Everyone down here is an alcoholic.
Oh. Do they have the highest consumption of everything else?
I would not be surprised if they do, because like, especially as you get towards the coast, like, drinking is a sport out here. So interesting.
Yeah. I lived in the South at one point too, and it was a very different drinking culture than in the Midwest.
Yeah. Well, I remember, you know, people drink heavily in South Dakota and Minneapolis as well. I think part of the reason there is just because it's so dang cold, and like, mm-hmm. there's nothing else to do in February, in January, you know?
That's like, true. Unless you want to go like cross country skiing or something lame like that.
Or like, you know, ice fishing or something.
Yeah, no but thanks.
I never did any of that, so.
No, I don't like being cold, so those are not.
Me neither, which is why I live in the South now.
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought it was appropriate that we're both drinking vodka, because vodka is Russian. I was so tempted to make a Moscow Mule, but, you know, only having raspberry vodka, actually, that might be good. The other vodka I have is vanilla vodka, and I feel like that would not be good in a Moscow Mule, but yeah. I'll try it. I'll report back. No?
All right. Please do. Okay. Yeah, no, it won't be horrible.
Well, yeah, who knows?
I mean, but you're also talking to a human garbage disposal. I'll eat and drink anything, so.
But Tchaikovsky is already one of the most featured conductors, composers. Whew. composers on this podcast. So I'm sure I'll have another opportunity to have a Moscow Mule.
Yes.
After I get regular plain vodka. But speaking of Tchaikovsky, I won't go too far into him and his life today because I've already featured him on two different episodes of this podcast. In season one, episode 13, which was about the Nutcracker, and then episode 18, which was about his violin concerto. But I will say, he's a Russian composer from the Romantic era. He was alive from 1840 to 1893. This piece, his Fourth Symphony in F minor, opus 36, was written between 1877 and 78. The first performance was in Moscow on February 22nd, 1878, or February 10th. Apparently the calendars were different then. That's what it says on Wikipedia. If you feel like doing a deep dive into calendars, I'm sure there's a podcast about it. Rubinstein was the conductor for the first performance. And I didn't know this. In Middle Europe, this symphony is sometimes called the Fate Symphony. Which makes sense. But I had never heard that before.
I don't know.
Thanks for your input.
I mean, it's Russian. Anything can be fake.
I mean, yeah, okay, that's true. So the symphony in total is about 40 minutes long. The first movement is, on average, 18 minutes long. It's one of Tchaikovsky's longest symphonic movements. The second is 9.5. The third is just under 6 minutes. And the fourth is around 8 minutes. He actually wrote a program. So I don't know that I've talked about this on the podcast before, but I think a lot of people listen to, you know, just select episodes. So there's program music and there's absolute music. And program music means that it's music built for a story. So like, an opera or a ballet is very clearly program music, but then there's also things like episode one of this podcast was Symphonie Fantastique, which doesn't have, you know, an acted out story like an opera or a ballet would have, but it has a story associated with music. So I also didn't know that Tchaikovsky had a story to go along with this symphony, but apparently the critics did not like that.
What was the story?
I didn't do deep enough of a dive into
it. All right. I mean, we can make up our own.
Sure. but this symphony is both program music and a reflection of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which is his Fate Symphony. And I think, I know I did a Beethoven 5 episode. I think it was episode 3 of season 1.
And the plot thickens.
The plot thickens. So I did my research from Wikipedia and this book called The Symphony by Preston Stedman that I used in grad school. And this is from Wikipedia. This is what Tchaikovsky said about the first movement of the symphony. All life is an unbroken alternation of hard reality with swiftly passing dreams and visions of happiness. I mean, yeah, that's dark.
In Russia, you don't play symphony. Symphony plays you.
Truly. Oh, I was also thinking when we decided to do symphony, the first time that I heard, you know, when we're like in youth orchestra and rushing and playing Russian music and the conductor stops and is like, just because the music is Russian doesn't mean you have to. It took me like at least 5 or 6 times to understand what the heck they were saying. Yeah. It was just like, I don't, what? But yeah. Details you don't care about when you're, you know, 13.
Yeah.
I can't remember if you said this before we started recording or if this was when we were talking beforehand, but you said this piece brings back a lot of memories for you. So would you like to share anything?
Yeah, I mean, nothing overly specific, but this was the first, one of the first, I want to say this was at the end of my first year in my youth orchestra, or my top youth orchestra. So I would have been like in the 8th grade.
Dang. Okay. Oh, and side note, you grew up in Kansas City, right?
Yes, I did. And we had a really great youth orchestra program then, so I was
Yeah, and
flying around me.
the Kansas City Symphony is also fantastic. That's a really, just a really
Yeah.
great place to grow up as a musician.
When I was a kid, they were I hope I don't get any flack for saying this, but when I was a kid, the KC Symphony was kind of, meh. But
Okay.
then soon after I left, they had some changeover in personnel, and I mean now the orchestra just kicks all kinds of,
But
they're so good.
they're great.
They have some fantastic players there now. My dad played in the orchestra for like right around 30 years, so he just retired a few years ago. So I grew up knowing a lot of the people in that orchestra. But yeah, my youth orchestra, I remember that first year, the first piece of big rep that I ever played was Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony. And oh my gosh, when you're like, what, 13 years old and staring down a 29-page orchestra part, like that's scary. But at the end of that year, we did Tchaik Four. And I just remember, being by that point, I was probably what, 14. And when you are a hormonal teenager going through a lot of angst and learning about all these different emotions that happen in life and being introduced to a piece of music like that, like on one hand, it's extremely cathartic, and on the other hand, it can also be very dangerous. Just because it's, I don't know. Like it almost like gives fuel to your emotional fire in a way. But I mean, I was also a very emotional kid, I was really sensitive to things like that. And so yeah, there are just feelings that when I hear the opening brass passage, and then when that ends, when the strings come in, makes my skin crawl. In a good way, like goosebumps. Just because, like, all this, emotional turmoil from when I was a kid, just it comes back, like a light switch. It's crazy.
Yeah, I didn't hear this piece, I think, until I was in college. Because I listened to Disney music as a kid, not classical music.
Nice.
But yeah, I think there's just something inherent about it that does give you goosebumps, or do you know what they call those in the South?
Palmetto bugs? I don't know.
Okay. Chill bumps.
Chill bumps.
Chill bumps.
Ooh, they call them chill bumps down here.
Yeah.
A palmetto bug, side note, is a flying cockroach.
Oh.
Yeah. And that's what we have here. Anyway,
Yeah.
continue.
Well, shall we continue with some music?
Yes, let's listen to some stuff.
Ooh, I think I can share my screen now. Yes, I can. Here we go. Okay.
Ooh,
Ooh, this is what the
fancy.
editing side looks like. Okay. So you mentioned the brass opening, and I actually did not play, or I didn't choose that because I think on its own it's enough of an attention grabber that it isn't one of the like anchoring things to encourage someone to listen to the symphony. So what I will play is not the beginning, but immediately after the beginning. So one of the biggest bummers about doing this remotely is I think you couldn't really hear that, right?
No, I could. I just wanted to hear the next section. That's all.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
I forgot that I did actually include a bit of the end of the opening. Just because I think the contrast between that loud brass opening and what happens in the strings next is just so stark and really cool. That's one of the things about classical music is things can change so suddenly. You just turn a corner and it's something different. But I really like just kind of like the softness of the strings there and it's like resting your head on a pillow at the end of a very tiring day. just think it's like one of the most wonderful ways to use a string section in the orchestra.
Yeah, it's a good metaphor. Yeah, this music, it's, you know, I last night I was going back and listening to this, the opening of this, and I'm not sure if I know quite how to put my thoughts into words, but just listening to the different textures that he weaves in and out of one another. Like, I don't know. I wish I knew how brains like that worked, number one.
Yeah, for sure.
And then, I don't know, you know, going back to this whole notion of absolute versus program music, I guess I'm of the camp that I think all music is program music, or at least that's how I look at it. You know, even the snooty, you know, New Viennese school for some of their stuff ultimately is some sort of program. Because I feel like, you know, what we do, being that it unfolds in time, it's a temporal art form, that it has to, in some ways, take the shape of a narrative. And I've always looked at it that way. And I've always been intrigued at how composers play with that and with structure in order to tell a story, you know. I don't know. I love how Tchaikovsky will play around with that, not only within the architecture of a section of music, but with how he takes several ideas at the same time and weaves them in and out. You know, it's almost like in my head, what I picture are like lines or groups of lines that circle around and dance around each other in shapes and colors.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. And we will get to some of that stuff in this symphony where he's making all of the parts like weave and dance around each other.
Yeah, but it is definitely an impactful opening because you have this loud contrapuntal brass stuff that's just like, you know, makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up, and then it all winds down. You have that one beautiful, like, chromatic sort of weepy sounding melody in the violins that comes in that just, yeah, it's like stabbing that knife right into your heart, twisting it slowly.
Truly.
Just like, you're just like savoring the pain in someone's face.
I wonder if this opening partially inspired Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, where there's that really ugly chord in the brass, but underneath it all, the strings are playing really softly, this really lovely chord. That's a piece that I would love to do on this podcast, but I am very limited by my licensing.
Yeah.
So Prokofiev is not in the wheelhouse. I don't remember when he'll be available, but it might be like 20 years from now. So
yeah. Well, no, that's a really good comparison. I never even thought of that one.
I hadn't until just now.
Because that opening of that suite with the Montagues and the
Capulets,
that's like some of the most bloody sounding music I think I've ever heard.
Oh, it's so great.
Just pure violence and that stuff, man.
That's a homework time. I haven't said that in a while on the podcast, but homework time. Listen to Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet.
And see if you want to like reenact Clockwork Orange or something while you do it. Jeez.
Shall we listen to the first official theme in the first movement?
Yes, let's do.
All right. I know, every time. It's like, oh, I just want to keep going. And that's not the first time you hear the theme. But I thought, you know, since I'm a violinist, I tend to feature the string section. So I thought it would be nice to feature the woodwinds instead.
Yeah.
And also in that part, I really like the heartbeat in the strings, the da-ga-da, da-ga-da going on in the background. I think that's just so impactful.
Well, and now that you bring that up, it kind of I think that's important, especially as you move forward and you get to the end of the Sixth Symphony with that heartbeat motive in that last movement, you know, and how that symphony ends.
Tchaikovsky's Sixth?
Mm-hmm.
I can't.
You know, where basically it's the horns, and it just, he slowly has the figure dun 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 go down and register throughout the orchestra, and then it ends in the basses. Basically, it's like it's you hear someone die in the piece, and that's the one where Tchaikovsky, I think he died 9 or 11 days after the premiere.
Oh, wow. Like that.
Yeah, it was widely rumored that piece was sort of a bit of a musical suicide note.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and especially if you look at the program of that symphony, mm-hmm. It's even more like, you know, life has shown me the highest of highs, but now it's just beaten me into this pulp and I can't go on anymore. It's intense, man.
Yeah. I mean, all of his music is intense.
Yeah. Right. In a good way.
Yeah. In a very good way. There's a reason he's been featured twice already on the podcast, and
yeah,
it might happen again.
Absolutely.
So the last clip that I had from the first movement, I wanted to talk about it a little bit first so that people know what to listen for. This oboe part reminds me of the beginning of one of the Star Wars themes. And it's very short. But if you know Star Wars and if you know the music, I think you'll hear it. If I remember correctly, it'll happen twice in this clip. And then I just love how this part starts out sounding really dramatic, and then you turn a corner and it's in major, and suddenly the feeling is just entirely different. And then the conversation between the strings and the woodwinds once the mood changes. So here you go. Here's some Star Wars for you guys.
It's so nice.
Yeah, it's so great. It's like longing, and then it's just placid.
Yeah, you know, it's, I don't know. If anything, it sounds almost like Italian right there at the end.
It does a little bit.
Like, or like fake Italian, I should say.
A Russian pretending to be Italian.
Well, I mean, he has the, what was it? The... wasn't it the overture, or was it the Capriccio Italian?
Oh yeah,
where he wrote that after he spent some time in Italy.
Oh, okay.
So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a little bit of that influence in.
Yeah, there probably is. I also like in that part, I didn't write this in my notes, so I forgot to say it beforehand, but the bassoon going
I was just going to say, I want to know why the hell he wrote that. Because you have this beautiful melody, and then you have these almost like mocking, like what the hell are those? Are they birds? Are they like...
There's some bird call type stuff in the fourth movement that I didn't include for the podcast, but it could be birds. My first thought goes to ballet and different characters. Like, there's a longing, you know, the oboe is someone who's, like, probably in love and, you know, is having their heart broken, or the person who's dealing with whatever fate situation they have. And then there's other people, like, maybe dancing and having a good time, or they're the haters that are like, it'll be fine. It's not that big of a deal. Go on with your life.
Or they're, like, little fairies that are, like, dancing around your head, being like, oh, Danny. Life will get better. Just keep your chin up.
I'm gonna go with the fairies. I like that one better.
You didn't need that girl anyway.
Yeah, they're fairies. can you imagine a bassoonist that would be a fairy?
Oh, especially in the bassoonist in the last orchestra I was in, yeah, back in South Dakota.
Oh.
He would be the perfect fairy in,
you know, he would pull that ballet. He would pull that part off really well.
He actually would. I would love to see that gentleman as a fairy.
It would be amazing.
Maybe someday I'll ask him to do that.
Yeah, he might listen to this podcast. I don't know.
Oh, boy.
So, anywho, the first movement is the longest of the four movements, as I said already. It's almost half of the length of the entire symphony. So there's a lot to listen to in here. I didn't cover everything because, you know, limited on time and all that business. But definitely worth a listen. But now it is time for the second movement. And speaking of the oboe opens this movement, but I decided, you know, the oboe gets enough attention. So I decided to start this where the strings take over the melody. It's just, it's so good.
You know what I love about his melodies is that they're so vocal, mm-hmm. you know, they like really you could so easily put words or lyrics to them and just like, you know, make a song out of them, make a tune out of them. And yeah. You don't do that.
I guess I didn't realize this or think about this beforehand, but did Tchaikovsky write much vocal music?
I'm not thinking of any right off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'm not thinking of any either.
Well, I mean, there's like Eugene Onegin, the opera. But
he wrote an opera?
That's the only... Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
That's the only thing I can think of. Because I don't remember him writing any... I mean, maybe he wrote choral works, but I don't know of any. But yeah. No songs for sure.
Huh.
So, I don't know.
I mean, I guess that's good for us because we got a great violin concerto and lots of good stuff to play in symphonies.
Yeah, and we got some decent chamber music out of it, too.
Yeah, truly. Yeah, so...
Sweet.
That's the melody of the second movement. And then the other bit that I wanted to share from the second movement is very characteristic Tchaikovsky, and that's all I'll say about it before we hear it.
Yeah, dude.
Like, that could have come from any of his pieces.
Yeah.
There's the trumpets going... and the pleading strings. And then at the end, that's one of his transitions that... You know, as much as I love Tchaikovsky, sometimes I think his transitions take too much time. Like, he hangs out for a little bit too long.
He's definitely one of the most long-winded composers, for sure.
He really is.
But, I mean, excerpts like that, excuse me, you can hear where, you know, Hollywood got all of their ideas pretty much for the last, like, I don't know, what, 80 years, maybe 100 years?
Yeah.
But I don't know, stuff like that made me, that's kind of where, how do I say, that's kind of what made classical music human to me, because... you know, when you're a kid and you're studying this stuff, you kind of make it out to be more than it is. Like, it's this super complex stuff that I can't understand, because I'm not smart enough or this or that. But then once you realize that it's just basically, you know, aural sugar, that it's basically just expressing the most basic of human emotions. Like, I love this person and they don't love me back, and so I feel like garbage. Like, oh, I can relate to that because I'm like 15 years old. And
Yeah, I really like that. And actually, earlier when you were talking about your solo project and saying that the way classical music is presented is boring, like that's exactly why I do this podcast, is to make it not so intellectual and, more approachable. I think a lot of people feel like I'm not smart enough to like classical music. And it's like, no, classical music is for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, all it is just a different way of expressing emotions, you know?
Yeah.
There's no two ways around it. So, but yeah, that goopy string sound is, take a bath in that stuff.
You could. Yeah, and the second movement actually doesn't have a ton of material. It's just that, I think pretty much that longing melody
Yep,
for the whole
pretty much.
movement, just in different instruments in the orchestra, with different accompaniments. So for a complete contrast from that cushiony, pillowy, frothy string sound, we get the third movement, where I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, the strings only ever play pizzicato, which is plucking the string instead of using the bow. So here's what the opening of that sounds like. Cute, and it's way more fun to listen to than it is to play.
You're not wrong. What I don't know if I could ever play this movement ever again without laughing. Because whenever I hear music like that, then maybe it's because I've been watching this show again recently, but it reminds me of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
I have never seen that show,
Oh
and
my
I keep
gosh,
meaning
yeah.
to watch it.
You need to watch it from the beginning all the way through.
Yes,
It's
sir.
such a brilliantly written show, but a lot of the soundtrack in the episodes is like this Leroy Anderson really fast pizzicato string sound. And yeah, it's and so now whenever I hear that movement, it makes me think of what the gang might be up to.
It's very tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
And it's a little cute, too.
Which
Like,
is
sarcastically cute.
you know, it's a nice palate cleanser for this piece, because yeah, I mean, with the next movement, I mean, the next movement does end pretty heroically, but still, it's another roller coaster ride, you know?
Yeah, it's overall a pretty dark symphony, so this is definitely a breath of fresh air. The other clip that I chose from this movement involves other instruments because, the opening is, there's a lot of pizzicato strings in this movement, but other instruments do get to play. And I actually don't remember exactly what I picked, but I wanted to talk about other instruments play, and then it sounds like ballet to me. So here we go. It sounds like the Nutcracker.
It does. Really close.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. It does sound like a lot like ballet music.
Which a lot of Tchaikovsky's music, I think, does, but yeah, it's like the third movement is just so playful.
Yes.
A true scherzo movement. So there's that. On to the fourth movement. We're really powering through this symphony.
That's fine.
The opening, like the first movement, is quite bombastic. And I chose not to play it because, again, it's attention-grabbing enough on its own. If you're lucky enough to have not heard this symphony before and hear this for the first time, then I envy you. So right after the bombastic opening, however, there's a Russian folk tune called A Birch Stood in the Meadow. So let's listen to that, and then I'll talk about the folk tune a little bit. Itself. So this is, you can look it up on YouTube. It's a very standard Russian folk song. It's a woman's song and sung on behalf of a young married woman. It's about a heroine married to the old and unloved. She is going into the woods to cut from the birch twigs and make musical instruments. And then she uses these instruments to wake up her husband. And that's all I have about the story. I'm sure there's more.
Is this like the Russian version of A Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein?
Could be. I don't remember how The Giving Tree goes.
Oh my God, it's so sad. I didn't reread The Giving Tree until my firstborn, you know, I started reading books to him. Mm-hmm. And I went back and read that book, and it is like one of the most depressing things ever. It's beautiful, but it's also very sad. Like, it's going to tug on your heartstrings. Huh. But much the same way that this piece does, you know. Yeah, this is last movement, Giving Tree. Makes total sense now. This would be the leaves falling off the tree as it gets more depressed because the young boy is growing up and taking all of its branches.
Yeah, and well, I was about to say that's really fun to play, but now I'm too bummed out to say that.
Yeah, I know, right? Which, I mean, I think most Russians would be proud of that.
So let's hear another instance where this folk tune shows up. It shows up all over in the fourth movement. But it's reorchestrated this time, and to me, it sounds, again, like ballet. I would say Swan Lake here. And the end of that clip is just so, like, it's, again, you've taken a hard left, like, you have this drama, and then...
It sounded like the birch tree turned into a great sequoia, like a really a pissed off great sequoia. I am going to kill you.
A Russian sequoia.
Yes, a Russian great sequoia. So that means that it's a tree that drinks vodka.
Oh, I wonder what would happen if I watered some of my plants with vodka.
It's what plants crave.
Or I wouldn't be watering them, I'd be vodka-ing them.
Drunken plants.
Drunken plants. Anyway, so the last clip that I chose from this piece is the B theme from the fourth movement, which, let's just listen to it first. And I'm going to leave it on a cliffhanger.
No, that's a cliffhanger.
So the B theme is the march, the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I didn't sing it right. I'm so sorry. I would take a drink, but I just spilled it all over my floor, actually.
Good job.
Thank you. But it's a march, and then I wanted to include that next part because it's just like a quintessential Tchaikovsky transition where you hear things past and then it's like a half step up and then another half step and then it's like it kind of keeps going like that for a while.
Yeah.
Just hit careful. My microphone.
Yeah, I mean, this, yeah, this last movement, it's like such a, you know, that's such a great thing about Tchaikovsky is, you know, for the romantic composers, he, his emotional swings were probably some of the biggest ones of all those composers. Like, I think, say him as opposed to, say, Brahms, and Brahms was like, probably the most dramatic German composer of the time. I mean, some might argue Wagner was, but I'm not a fan of Wagner, so I'm going to leave him out of this equation or this argument.
Okay.
I prefer Brahms. I like Brahms because, like, he was so emotional and hard on the sleeve, but also so heady, so intellectual. And I think Tchaikovsky was just a little bit more like it's like all emotion, man. Like, you know, if you were in high school again and Brahms was like that emotional nerd, then Tchaikovsky was like that emotional nerd's best friend who was just all emotion and no nerd. You know, just like crying like one day and then the next day like flying on cloud nine and like just needs to get to the doctor to get a little bit of meds just to sort of level out, but doesn't have the money to. And so here we go again on Peter's wild ride. It's it's always interesting.
It is always interesting. I love Tchaikovsky so much. He was one of my very early composer loves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, he's one of those that I can always go back to and just have a really good time listening.
I hear you. I'm the same way. It's good stuff.
So, to wrap up my previous episodes this season, we've talked a little bit about COVID-19 and like kind of how to deal with it, but you and I actually recently read the same book. And I think this is, I mean, probably applicable, definitely applicable in these times, but applicable all the time. So I'll say the name of the book. It's called The Upside of Stress by Kelly McGonigal. And I was recommended the book by my friend Ian after a few bad audition experiences. And then I recommended it to you. So I guess we haven't even discussed this yet, but
no
thoughts.
Well, I'm not done. I'm about maybe 2/3 of the way through. So,
okay.
But it's very interesting and yeah, I would love to talk about it.
Yeah. Okay. So I thought you had finished. The end, I thought, was really, really interesting, like the last section, but I won't say anything.
Well, I mean, feel free. You can go on ahead. It's not like, you know.
I mean, I suppose it's not like fiction where there's spoilers.
No. I'm going to discover this about myself anyway.
So she talks through the whole book about how stress has gotten a bad rap, and there are all these studies that say how bad stress is for you, but then her argument is it actually makes you better. We've all heard these things like what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, you can choose to be bitter or better. But I really like how she backs everything up with scientific studies, and it's really just a mindset intervention, which I thought was really interesting. It's like you can simply read the book and think like, well, there were, you know, pre-online teaching, there were a few days a week where I would teach at one location, a violin lesson, and then I'd go to a different location and teach cello lessons, and then go back to another location and teach violin lessons. And, like, I do my own practicing on top of that and, like, you know, all the administrative work that comes with being a musician and a teacher. And those days just, man, they sucked. And you know, reading this book, I started telling myself, like, this isn't something that I, like, get to have feelings about. It's just, like, this is a thing I do, and when I'm in the moment with these students, I'm, like, I'm there for them, and I'm happy to be in the moment with them. So that was kind of my big mindset intervention, I guess.
Nice. Yeah, I'm working on a couple right now. I think because of a lot of the things that I've been through in my life, which is like, I won't go into detail here, but I've been through a few things. And consequently, I've dealt with a lot of stress and still continue to cope with that stress on a daily basis. Not always in the healthiest way, and sometimes in the healthiest way. Like, that's the stress is what got me into weightlifting, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, that's an outlet that I discovered. So in my personal life, it's going to help out in the long run, but then also in my professional life too, because I still deal with nerves on stage in different capacities. You know, it's been a few years since I've taken an orchestra audition, but even after reading this book, like I want to take another audition when they're back up and running, just to see what practices I can put into play in terms of changing how I think about things, you know.
Yeah, I'll probably reread this again before I take another orchestra audition, because it got me pumped about the possibility of taking an audition.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I thought about was, you know, going back to my last, most recent audition memories, is especially, you know, being in your warm-up room, which, you know, I was lucky that my last several auditions, I had a warm-up room. It wasn't cattle call.
Yeah, or the Shark Tank, which, I've heard it called.
Yeah. I mean, either or. I mean, which those auditions are special.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have your own warm-up room. I'm in there for, like, you know, close to an hour, you know, just playing, doing my pre-audition rituals, and you're, like, telling yourself to stay calm. You know, you take your beta blockers, and then it's so vivid, you know, like they come and you hear the fate knock on your own door. Might as well be Tchaikovsky himself banging on your door.
Or like, have you ever had the feeling when you hear the knock on the door and you're like, is that my door or is that the person next to me? It's like you're just so freaked out in those situations. You really can't think straight sometimes.
And then, you know, it's like they're taking you to the gallows on stage.
Yes.
And like you're doing the long walk down the hall and like you're already starting to get the jitters in your knees and, you know, your heart rate's starting to go up and you got that feeling like in your core everything's starting to tighten up already, and as much as you're like shaking your hands out and you can feel the blood leaving your fingertips and starting to get cold, like your chest is hot but your fingers are freezing cold and you're like, oh,
what
shoot
is happening?
here we go again. You get closer to the door and the door opens up and you see that long carpet going out to the center of stage so they can't hear your feet on the stage floor, and you see that long line of curtains up, and you see, you know, there's like 10 to 15 people sitting randomly behind that curtain and it's quiet. You can hear a pin drop on the stage. You can hear yourself breathe. It's like, oh my gosh, I might as well be naked right now.
And every page turn is just like the loudest thing you've ever done. It's like,
like the pages are going, give up now. And you're like, oh no. And then like you make one mistake, you're like, I can recover. Two mistakes, no, three mistakes, there goes the job.
Right.
And you're like, after one extra, be like, I might as well just walk off the stage now. But no, you gotta like power through it. So all of that stuff, even what we just described, and like I think that's how intense the experience is that we can remember in such detail each one of those. Mm-hmm. And if we can learn to, instead of suppress or try to suppress that biological and psychological reaction of like, this is horrible, I need to like not feel this way so that I can play well and get this job and feed my children. And that's another part of the psychology of it too, is, you know, putting all this unneeded pressure on your back, you know, which as musicians, especially in our form of music, we learn to do from a very young age, sadly. Mm-hmm. Learn to, instead of suppress those reactions, like like, I want to go to an audition and like do cartwheels down the hallway to the stage. Bring it on.
Yeah. So one of the things she said in her book is, don't think about it as nerves. Think about it as I'm excited. 'Cause this is the fight or flight response that we're feeling when we have these weird feelings right before an audition. And you know, biologically that is meant to help us. And it can be hard to remember that when you're trying to control such small muscle groups.
I think that's why as musicians, we try to counteract that, because that physical reaction gets, sometimes it does get in our way, because when you know, as violinists especially, as soon as you get those little jitters, like there goes your bow control, or you know, you tighten up and then your shifts start going all wonky and and this and that. But if we can find a way to harness that and physically use that energy, then I think
I didn't think about this when I was reading the book, but this just came to mind. Did you ever see Captain Marvel?
Captain America?
Marvel.
Marvel.
Yeah, the one with Brie Larson.
No, I don't think so.
Spoiler alert, if you have not seen it, I hope this isn't a spoiler for you.
It's fine.
But just go forward like a minute or something. So she grows up on the planet of the Kree, and she has these bracelets that help her control her power. But she was hit with, I think it was gamma rays, whatever makes the Hulk become the Hulk. You know, that's the thing that affects everyone and gives all, like, humans their superpowers in the Marvel Universe. But towards the end of the movie, she, like, takes them off and realizes suddenly, without trying to control that power, she has all this power that she wasn't aware of. And she can just, like, annihilate everything. And that's kind of, you know... What if we use that energy that we're feeling to our advantage instead of trying to make it go away?
Yeah. And it's funny because like in weightlifting, like you want that, you know, like, I've only done a couple of competitions or meets in the past. I'd like to do another one, but, you know, that's what you look for is like if you look at a powerlifting meet, sometimes you'll see people like slapping each other, or like hit, they slap each other on the back really hard, or like old school guys, they will slap you in the face repeatedly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like and then like you a lot of guys will breathe in ammonia, like you have ammonia capsules or bottles, because the ammonia is supposed to like somehow open up your lungs, and so you get a bigger breath in so you can brace for a bigger weight. So that along with you know, smacking you is supposed to, like, you know, I guess start up these stress reactions, basically, like get all those hormones going in your body, in your brain, so that you get the adrenaline going, so that you know, you get stronger basically before you go out there and lift. Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
That's what you do.
Wow.
And that's part of it. Like even a friend of mine back in Sioux Falls, who was a former professional MMA fighter, I was weightlifting with him one day a couple of years ago when I was back there. And I had kind of altered my mindset whenever I was lifting heavy weights. Like, I was like kind of being more relaxed, you know, not trying to like not waste energy basically. Mm-hmm. But I realized that I had kind of gone too far in that direction. He told me, he's like, you need to attack the weights. I was like, huh? He's like, attack them. And I was like, oh yeah, you're right. So that's when, you know, like if I'm lifting a heavy weight, I'll stand there and I'll start talking to myself and like breathing heavy, like grunting, sometimes yelling, like basically whipping yourself up into a frenzy. Yeah, because you can injure yourself when you're trying to pick up, you know, 500 pounds or, you know, do something like that. Mm-hmm. And so the more that you gain all that strength and those chemicals in your head, that helps to, you know, dig deeper into your central nervous system to gain those muscle fibers so that you can, it'll keep you from getting injured and you can lift that weight. So, wow, I actually hadn't really thought of this before, but that's yet another parallel between weightlifting and performing. Like there's a lot actually.
I believe
even
it,
like in,
yeah.
in training cycles and things like that. So.
Yeah, I don't do a lot of, well, what I do in the gym is not considered powerlifting at all, but you know, the more time I spend in the gym and thinking about working out, I think the more I find parallels between practicing and being, you know, physically fit. It's
yeah.
Everything is so connected, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, it totally is.
And so. Just to wrap up about the book, the very last section, the author talks about how she's gotten criticism for saying that stress is good for you. And I thought that part was maybe the most fascinating. Like by the time you get there, you're kind of beaten over the head with the mindset intervention thing. You're like, I get it. And then it takes this total, you know, again, left turn where it's like, she's gotten criticism for people saying like, oh, so you're saying I should have bad things happen to me so I can be better. And I thought her defense for that was really interesting. And
yeah.
I think especially in these times when we're all trying to deal with, you know, people keep talking about the new normal, but like it's a thing that's coming. But I think this right now is our new normal. And I don't know. I just think it's really worthwhile for everyone because we're all dealing with stuff right now. We're all trying to figure it out. And,
yeah. You know, one thing that I told a friend of mine when all this started was that I'm going to get up on a bit of a soapbox here,
okay.
Which I don't care. You know, when all this started and we had to shut down and stay home, I was going into this with the hope that in our culture in particular in America, that we would take this as a chance or take this as an opportunity for some like serious long-term reflection,
mm-hmm.
you know, on who we are as human beings, who we are as neighbors and friends and brothers and sisters to one another. Because our culture, you know, there's so many like beautiful yet I'll just go out and say it ugly things about our culture. And you know, one of the things that is both beautiful and ugly at the same time is our, the initiative that we take. Like we're a go-getter country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, we're very much built on that principle. And that is so admirable on one hand. And on the other hand, it's very, I feel like it takes us away from ourselves. You know, we get so distracted by things, by short forms of media, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or TikTok or YouTube, things like that. And having multiple screens in our faces all the time. I think, and that's just one part, like work is a distraction. The radio is a distraction. Like I can't tell you how, you know, even in my own life on a day-to-day basis, how many distractions I find and how that keeps us from really looking inward and being comfortable when you look inward. Like that's the scary part. And that's actually one thing that I've had to really struggle with in the last 2.5 months is I thought I'd be like really cool with that, but it's actually been like kind of frightening sometimes,
mm-hmm.
you know, when at the end of the day, it's just you and yourself. There is nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
It's you, yourself and the universe or God. If you, you know, if you partake in that, which I don't mean to put that tritely. I don't mean to offend anyone who's religious out there by any means. And this book really helps out with that because if you learn to, in many ways, embrace that stress and don't look at it as this handicap, but you look at it as something, certainly like long-term chronic stress, yeah, that's going to be bad for you. I think that's why my biological father had to get a kidney transplant years ago because of hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about you know, everyday stresses, you know, and some big life events, like, you know, stuff that I've had to learn to cope with. I don't know where to wrap up with this big long tangent, but
I think the great thing is she does a really good job of defending herself, is big things might happen to you, you can't control it, but you can come back from it. And I think that's what she's trying to say with all of her research about this. And, you know, we'll come back from this too. And I really like what you said about, I don't think you said it in exactly these words, but, you know, slowing down and being more introspective and being more you rather than the things that you've accomplished. I think there's a lot of just pressure in our culture to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all on this planet together. We have to try to love one another. But, you know, that really, it sounds cheesy, but it's true. You have to start with yourself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it is absolutely true. Well, usually I would end this with a cheers and then like a clink of the glass, but we'll say cheers at the end and then we'll just say clink. But I wanted to thank everyone who's listened to this episode. If you liked it, please subscribe on iTunes or Spotify. On iTunes, you can rate and review. That's a free way to support the podcast and make it more visible to other people who might have money and might be interested in becoming a Patreon subscriber. That's patreon.com/poriamozart. You can be a supporter for $3 a month. You can also, because we all need more screens right now, follow it on Instagram and Facebook at Pour Me a Mozart. And yeah, that's all the social media business I got to do. Thank you for joining me. It was really great to have you as a guest on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It was fun. Yeah. I want to do it again.
Yeah, for sure. We'll pick another piece. We'll do it again.
Sweet.
But for now, cheers.
Cheers.
Clink.
Clink.